you hear me now? So anyway, as I was saying, the Material Brain is actually the name of the big project which is run by the Center for Neuroengineering at the Penn State, where one of the directors, Bruce Gutmann, is actually here. And I'm trying to do the coupling, really, between the electrochemistry of the brain and the mechanics of the brain. And of course, the big advantage of being at Penn State is that the Material Research Institute is there, and if we need any help from them, we can always ask them to help. So what I'm going to talk about are some attempts of modeling in modeling the response of the brain from a mechanical point of view, but also taking into account some electrochemistry of the brain in there. So really, that's why the name of neuromechanics came about, trying to actually signal that we are not just looking at the mechanics of the brain, but also at some of the electrochemistry of the brain, if you want to call it that way. So the first model I'm going to show is this triphasic model, where instead of just having a solid and a fluid, we also have some ionic things wandering around. And I'm going to show you a simulation for normal pressure hydrocephalus. The second one is actually a rather interesting model that came from Dr. Wyman's model. We call the neuromechanical model 2, where we are actually trying to use fMRI signal to predict the brain mechanics. So it's, the idea here is, can we actually make use of clinical information into our modeling? Because experiments are great, but they are very invasive. Can we actually somehow come closer to the clinicians and use their information and in our model? And finally, I'm going to touch on the magnetic resonance elastography part, because one thing that is actually problematic with all the mechanical models is we have no idea how stiff the brain is and how we can actually measure this in a non-invasive way, right? So I'm going to actually show you again of a sine MRI, actually, of a brain with, of a patient with carry malformations and how we perform a short stiffness analysis on it. And I'm going to also show you how we can actually use image mass spectroscopy to differentiate between low-grade and high-grade glioma. So as you can see, it's an entire talk here. So what are the challenges? Of course, the brain microstructure. So for the last 3 years, I was hitting heads with Bruce Rutman about the brain microstructure, and I'm getting more confused as the day passes, because as you can all know, the microstructure is very involved. We have all kinds of cells, we have arteries and veins of all kinds of dimensions, and not only that, they are connected with each other, and it's multi-scaling, multi-layered, however, extremely organized structure. Not only that, but they interact with each other. So we have this neuroglial vascular coupling, which is still quite unknown for us, although my colleague Patrick Drew is going to give you some more information tomorrow about this. Because, of course, if something doesn't go right here, where all these chemical reactions are happening, the mechanics is going to immediately react to it. So you are going to see probably at the macroscopic level something going wrong. So I'm going to start with normal pressure hydrocephalus. I apologize for all the people who already know about it, but I'm a mathematician, so I have to remind myself what I'm looking at. So this is a neurological disorder characterized usually by gain disturbance, mental deterioration, in the absence of increasing intracranial pressure. So that's the way it looks in a normal brain, and this is when you see the enlarged ventricle happening. Now, this appears to be a disorder that develops in older people. It is often misdiagnosed, because it can be actually, the symptoms are specific to other clinical conditions specific to older people. And the cause, of course, of MPH is usually unknown. But of course, as we start to grow, to live longer, and the cases of MPH might actually increase, and of course the treatment required, the treatment costs are going to grow as well. As you already heard over and over today, the condition can be actually treated by implanting the shunt. However, it turns out that the extent of improvement after the shunting varies greatly. Only up to 65% of the patients respond positively, and the morbidity is pretty high. So if we can actually somehow bring the model up to be able to predict what's happening after the shunting, that would be actually good. So what we need, you need me here. I'm of course joking. So this where everything started. Everything started with Akim and Adams in 1965. They were the first who actually tried to describe from a more engineering point of view what it could happen in the brain. So pretty much all the existing biomechanical models for normal pressure hydrocephalus are based on the famous Wilks flow theory. The driving force of the CSF blood flow is the CSF pressure at the production side being slightly in excess of the pressure at the absorption side. What are the limitations? Of course, MPH is incompatible. If really we believe that normal pressure hydrocephalus is occurring in the absence of the increased intracranial pressure, then we can't really use the Bulk theory to describe it. Plus, can we actually make use of some clinical information? Where is the biology or the chemistry happening that could actually improve the model? So what we actually decided to do is to open the Pandora box, really. This three-phase mechano-electrochemical model has been proposed actually for a long, probably 2000, by Mao group to look at cartilage. Okay, so that's where they actually come up with this, where they were saying, okay, let's account for a solid phase, a fluid phase, and also an ionic phase. So that's what we are actually assuming. Let's say that the brain is this hydrated soft tissue, which has an incompressible porous permeable charged solid phase, the interstitial fluid, which is incompressible and electrically neutral. And finally, we assume that we have positively and negatively charged groups on the solid phase called cis charges. I don't know if those exist, but we go with this assumption for the time being. And of course, I forgot to mention the ionic phase. For the time being, we assume only two species, but we can put as many as we please if we consider that we need it. So this is just a short schematic of what we have here, the fixed charges, the ionic moving ones, and of course the fluid everywhere else. So this is like a small cell inside the brain. And I have to put the equations on. I had a student who started his PhD, and after I put his equations on, he said that he was going to finish with a master. I'm not joking, they are pretty nasty. So we have the classic equation here where some of you might actually recognize the linear elastic part, but we also have all these electrochemical potentials coming into the second part, and of course all the equations for the fluid, and of course the diffusion equation for the two ionic concentrations. So really the model is pretty involved. So what we said, okay, let's try a 1D case, at least to see if this model gets any results. Otherwise, there's no point in going directly to a 3D model and get stuck because we can't go anywhere else. So these are all the mechanical parameters that we have to take into account, diffusivity coefficients, electrochemical potential, and displacement. So the 1D model we designed was here. So this is the skull. This is the ventricular wall surface, and this is the brain tissue. So what we actually really want to see is if we don't have any pressure difference between the CSF here and the interstitial fluid here, can we see a displacement here? In other words, can we see this wall moving down by simply changing the ionic concentrations in the CSF? Okay. So now, of course, nothing is there, so I had to make up my own toy. So what we actually said, okay, since we don't know anything about this condition, we're going to start with the most common two ionic concentrations in CSF, which are just the sodium and the chloride. Again, I don't know this thing, so that's why I was asking this person Miles this morning for chemistry, because really it is here where we need information about it. The boundary conditions are, of course, continuity everywhere of all those potentials. And we assume that the ionic concentration of salt in the ventricular CSF decreases from a normal value to some abnormal value that we prescribe. So what happens? So these are the parameters that we use. Again, I need to figure out these parameters. This is just a numerical simulation, so nothing is real. It's just me playing with the numbers. However, what we actually do see is actually the displacement. In other words, what this negative value here, that's actually displacement of the ventricular wall. So it actually moves just by simply playing with the change in the ionic concentration of the source. A much more interesting thing now after I saw Richard's talk earlier is, look at that minus 0.2 displacement he noticed for the normal pressure hydrocephalus. So what I was playing with here with is the initial porosity. So what we see is that as the initial porosity actually changes, the displacement is more pronounced. So it's rather interesting that it's not the mechanics doing that, it's actually the ionic concentration. And then again, we play to this initial charge densities, and we notice exactly the same. So it's an initial swelling, and then again, this shrinkage of the brain tissue. So now, what we see is, it appears that it can predict at least the transient shrinkage of the brain tissue in patients with NCH. Now, the nice part is that, and this is what actually gets me excited, what if we can actually treat this pharmaceutically rather than in a more invasive way? I don't know, but that's really what I'm after. And then, of course, what's important, the most important part here, okay, those are mechanical parameters that I need to actually find somehow from some measurements or invoke them from somewhere else. And especially these diffusion properties, or what are the ions that really are the cause of hydrocephalus. I am going to mention this recent work that we actually have done at Penn State. So Dr. Schiff proposed this mouse model, so really just taurine injected to generate hydrocephalus. What we are trying to do with this one is to actually look at pediatric hydrocephalus. Why? This was actually Kessel and Jim Drake paper from 1999, where they were proposing this type of schematic in deciding the treatment for pediatric kids. What we try to do is to add this predictive mathematical framework here in order to be able at least to distinguish between third ventriloscopy and shunting. In other words, we are going to use our brain model, okay, whatever we know from the human brain dynamics, in other words, teeth, to be able to say something about untreated hydrocephalus and use our biomechanical model here to decide which of these two are actually the way to go. So it's like embedding this mechanics into a dynamical system approach. Okay, that's also good, mainly because you remember I have all kinds of parameters that I have no idea what they are. Maybe a dynamical system approach will actually help us figure out what those mechanical parameters could be. So this is really where we are after. This is the ultimate goal, is to be able to, our model is to say, okay, this is what you want to do, or this is what you want to do. So it's like a computer-aided strategy for neurosurgeons to actually decide which of the two is probably the best way, depending, of course, on the patient. So that's one piece. Now I'm going to shift you forward. So that was hydrocephalus. Now we are going to the next model. So again, the idea here is, can we use what the clinicians use to actually predict mechanics? And the answer is here, it might be yes. As most of you know, BOLT, or blood oxygen level dependent fMRI signal, it's an indirect measure of the neural activity that depends on the neurovascular coupling. So it appears that the neural activity alters the cerebral blood flow, cerebral blood volume, and the blood oxygen consumption. I will let Patrick to get more in detail about this tomorrow, since this is all I was able to learn about it. And this is really what the BOLT signal is actually measuring. What I liked about this particular paper in Natural Reviews in 2003 is that the expositor is actually showing a signal intensity in time of healthy controls versus short patients when they are performing a very simple task of typing, of finger tapping. Okay? So really all it's saying is that actually the short patients don't have the same signal intensity as the normal patients. So it doesn't fit. So somehow a damage did happen to that particular brain. Now, what I'm trying to do now is to use that information, which is obviously non-invasive information, it's just functional MRI, in predicting the mechanics. So what I'm assuming here is that the brain tissue is locally isotropic, homogeneous, non-Hookean elastic polymorphic material. So I'm starting with the simplest possible mechanical model. However, I'm assuming now suddenly that this is has two microscopic states, one which is active and one which is at rest. Okay? In other words, one when I'm assuming that the person doesn't do anything, and then the other one when the person starts to tap with the finger. And then I'm going to actually use this ball signal data into the mechanics and see if this actually gives anything else. So really, this is just to see if we can use neural imaging measurements in predicting brain mechanics and nothing else. So what we did was we created this experimental plot. We have a 1D brain tissue that we stretch it. Okay? And during this stretch, independently, that neural activity starts to happen. Okay? So it's not caused by the stretch. It's actually something that it happens. It's an electrochemical thing happening. And we are using this constitutive law, where really the only difference between whatever people use right now is this activation function. So really, this is where everything it says, hey, by the way, if you have neural activity, this function is going to actually start to feel that. And what we noticed is something that it's known actually in the literature of soft tissue, namely what's called stress softening. What it means is that as the stretch ratio increases, you are going to see, instead of this classic Neo-Hookean model that it simply says that I'm going to go as fast as I can to break, right, to damage, it softens. Okay, so it allows for a little bit of for larger deformations to happen without damage. This is the normal. So this is where stress softening in normal people happens. In other words, our brain appears to actually support quite a bit of stress and stress. The short patient, however, is going to get damaged much faster. So this is kind of nice because, again, I'm coming back to what my point is. To use things that you can measure in a non-invasive way and estimate the mechanics of the brain. So really that's what all this thing is going on. So what we actually will try to do further is, of course, investigate other ways of imaging and trying to come closer to what really the mechanics is from this measurement. And finally, what else we can do with medical images? As you can see, I'm wandering around imaging. Image elastography has been actually touched a little bit by Jim this morning, the elastography part. So what exactly this whole story is, you want to find material parameters of biological tissues in vivo. That's the important part, it's in vivo. And map them, of course, in an anatomically meaningful image, and that's actually what's an elastogram for. So we can use it, of course. The first reason why this actually was developed at Mayo Clinic in 1990s, I think, was to look for tumors. So really, that was the thing, because you actually know that a tumor tends to be stiffer than harder than the surrounding normal tissue. So really, that's what started all this elastography thing. Trauma and surgical simulations, exactly what Jim was mentioning this morning. Really, you want to know how stiff that brain is in order to be able to simulate the surgery as realistic as possible. And then, of course, in the design of prosthetic and protective devices, think only at the NFL players who actually get hit in their head so much, they do get damaged regardless. So if you can protect their heads better, that would be wonderful. And of course, the imaging modalities are exactly the modalities that are used by the clinicians today, more or less optics. So really, this is just one example from when I was at Mayo that we were working on. So this is the classic MRI of a tissue that actually has a tumor in it. So now if the radiologist is not very doesn't have too much experience, might actually say there is no tumor there. The pathologist said, no, the tumor is here, and this is what the MRI says. It actually was able to pick up relatively well where the tumor was located. And again, this is a non-invasive way. You don't have to cut and do the pathology, right? So it's actually pretty useful in that regard. What can we image? Strain, stress, velocity, whatever you think you are actually is important for you. The type of excitations are classic. from a mechanical point of view. You can do static elastography, where you are simply compressing the tissue. You can do dynamic, where a time harmonic excitation is actually applied on the boundary to create a harmonic wave propagating through the tissue. You can do a time-dependent pulse, and actually this transient elastography could be very useful in simulating brain trauma, for example, right? Because that's something you can't actually do even with animals, leave alone people, right? And finally, you can actually use acoustic radiation forces by focusing an ultrasound beam at a chosen location, and that's the remote elastography. So since I was at Mayo, they were doing the dynamic MR. So in other words, the MR images were recorded while a vibrating plate plays on the skin, propagates mechanical shear waves in the tissue, okay? So if you pulse the magnetic field in MR scanner in tune with the mechanical vibrations, then you can actually kind of freeze the wave and you can measure the wavelength. Once you have the motion encoded phase contrast based MRI, uses usually the change in the phase shift of the protons in the region of interest to create an image. And then, of course, in the linear regime, I can actually use this to estimate the displacement field. And then with the displacement field, of course, I can find the Young modulus or the stiffness of the tissue. This is an inverse problem, so for the mathematicians in the room that will ring the bell, it's probably one of the toughest problems you can actually handle in mathematics. So this is a design. So what actually they did for the brain, they actually designed two different systems. One was initially here, and they were actually going back and forth at around 100 hertz. That's very uncomfortable. So the engineer who actually was doing this, was designing this actually, because he was actually doing the experiment on himself, and this one did actually generated a big migraine, so he actually had to give up on this because it was very uncomfortable. However, this one, shaking inside the mount, was actually better and safer. Really, the idea was to send waves, mechanical waves in the brain to be able to image them. Well, what they actually did, they assumed, of course, the classic thing, which is not always necessarily true, that the brain tissue is homogeneous, isotropic, almost incompressible, linear elastic. So that means that I can actually evaluate a shear modulus. And from this vocal frequency estimation, you can actually generate a formula for your shear modulus. And this is the elastogram of the brain. So this is what they actually came up with. By the way, white here in CSF. CSF doesn't, in CSF you don't have shear waves propagating, so that's why it's nothing there. What they found is that white matter values are about 14 kilopascal, and while the gray matter values are about 5 kilopascal. Now, I will argue, hey, given the microstructure of the brain, the neurons and the way they are actually connected, I'm not expecting to have the same stiffness all over the brain. So the brain shouldn't be homogeneous, right? So I would rather be looking for local stiffness values rather than this global thing. However, how it turns out, as you'll see further, it appears that is strangely the case. Last year, the ISMRI meeting, which is the biggest meeting in medical images, they actually said, why should we send external waves to the brain when we can use the natural pulsations of the brain to evaluate the stiffness? So they came up with this idea of recording sine MRI, okay, and use a fitting technique. They actually found again that this global average shear modulus for the white matter is 14 kilopascals. So it was rather strange, but anyway. So what we actually decided to do, one of my collaborators from Hershey, Dr. Mark Antosta, he said, I have some data of sine MRI of a patient with carry malformations before and after the surgery. So let's see if we can use the same approach for the carry malformation. So I'm just going to quickly go over what I understood about carry malformations. It's a clinical condition discovered in 1890s by actually Hans Carey, in which the cerebellum portion of the brain protrudes into the spinal canal, blocking the flow of the CSF. Many times it actually can be symptom-free, so you might actually be lucky enough to live with it, but of course it can also have lots of nasty symptoms. This is what the statistics about the condition. And of course, CM is frequently misdiagnosed because of the complex symptomology, and there is no single objective test which can clearly say that someone has has a chiral malformation. And this is actually a movie. If it's going to start, that would be wonderful. This is before the surgery, so really the problem is you can barely see the CSF moving here, while after the surgery, so after they remove that portion of the bone there, the CSF actually started to be a little bit more freer there. So what we did is we actually pretty much took what Zhao proposed, which is fitting model, and we had exactly the same definition he had for the shear modulus, as being that ratio is even there. And what we noticed, instead of saying I'm going to look for the global value, we just picked up small windows in the brain and said, okay, let's see what the values are. So before surgery, the numbers are everywhere. As you can see, the red here is almost 60 kilopascals, so it's where, exactly where the blockage of the CSF is, and 11, 26. Again, this is not the true Young modulus. This is an apparent Young modulus in the sense that, of course, if I don't have the CSF, there is no force pushing into the brain, right? So what I'm saying is that's probably not really the how stiff the brain is. It's just that I don't have the force to really measure this. However, post-surgery, the values are very close together. So we just put them all together, and here is what 14.2 value was always declared before, and this is what we noticed after the surgery. So really it appears that before the surgery brain was more inhomogeneous, it appeared more inhomogeneous and stiffer, while after the surgery the values start to be relatively close to this 14 kilopascal found. So what we actually conclude, this might be a non-invasive measure of chiral malformation treatment outcome. However, it can also be used to estimate to estimate the stiffness of the brain. Really, that's what it's important to us. What's new now is that no elastogens of brain tumor has been reported yet. Okay, so this is another issue. Really, if you remember, the elastography was not developed because suddenly the clinicians needed to know how stiff the brain is. For them, that's irrelevant. What's important is what if a tumor is present? Do we have a way to actually say by simply looking at an image, this is a tumor or not? It's not only that. Can we differentiate between a benign and a cancer tumor? Because that's really the most important part in a non-invasive way. So in other words, bypassing the biopsy. So now, the microscopy models of continuum mechanics using MRE cannot differentiate between low and high grade glioma. That's clear cut. So we really need information from the microstructure and the biochemical processes to understand what's happening there. So in other words, what my aim now is, can we improve the elastography procedure by using some information from another place? And the answer came from this paper by Shorand in 2005, who said, hey, let's do image mass spectroscopy instead of the classic profile spectroscopy. So really, this is the profiling where you just use the classic droplet and then acquire mass spectra and you generate a profile. Imaging is you actually spray coating the tissue, do the acquisition, and you generate an image of where your proteins are actually happening. And they actually published, they have two results that were interesting. This one first, which actually shows protein profiles for low and high grade gliomas. So you can immediately see that there is a difference between the two. And these images, which are of importance to my model, so this is the high grade at different mass per charge ratios, and these are the low grade at the same mass per charge ratio. So you say, okay, so what can you do with that? Well, I can start to imagine things. So what I assumed was the following, that the relative intensities that we actually see of proteins are proportional to the corresponding concentrations. That's not my own idea. Was this actually, this guy who actually was doing ionization and atmospheric things. So I said, okay, atmosphere, brain, space. And then I said, okay, what if the apparent Young modulus of a tissue sample is proportional to the concentrations of proteins? And not only that so this is the sum of the concentrations, but this alpha n depends on the mass per charge ratio. So by doing that, So I said, okay, two cases. Of course, the easiest case is what if alpha n's are all constant, and the second one is a function of the mass per charge ratio. And these are the elastograms to obtain. So for the hydroid glioma for constant alpha, the value turns out to be about 60 kilopascal, and for the low-grade glioma, about 45 kilopascal. I remind you, the way I fixed the parameters were just by looking, trying to have the 14 kilopascal for the normal tissue, and then playing with the alpha. And much more realistic appears to be this case, where actually that alpha depends effectively on the mass-to-charge ratio, and these are the values that we actually obtain. So what it appears is that at least it appears that the high-grade glioma is at least 10 kilopascals stiffer than the low-grade glioma. And that's the interesting fact, because really if you can just simply say from an elastography, from elastogram, hey, this is 25 kilopascal, this is low-grade, you are probably okay, versus, oh, this is high-grade glioma, this is not okay. So really, this was really the whole aim of doing this. Of course, we still have to actually figure out if indeed I can actually connect the Young modulus to this mass per charge ratio, because that's actually the most important piece that comes into play here. And thank you so much. This is I always found this particular cartoon interesting because that's me, I. And usually the neurosurgeons are sitting here. Yes, Mia. Thank you so much. They are frequency dependent, that's correct. So in this moment, we actually did only the in the elastic regime. So we did not look yet at the viscoelasticity of the brain tissue. No, they are hertz. No, they are hertz. They have to be, I think they were at 100 hertz performed. Yes, and even lower, between 80 and 100, depending on, yes. Yes, Trish. So we just have to validate that. I have to. So I'm just taking the data and looking at them and say, okay, this is what the model says. So really, the reason why I'm more interested actually in the in Zhao paper from last year is because he's trying to use the natural pulsations of the brain, and that's really what you want. You don't want to send waves from outside the brain, because really this is not a homogeneous material. Depending where you are actually sending the waves, you are going to get a different result. That's really the bottom line. Yes, ma'am. Yes. That's a good one. I don't know. I have to admit. I don't know that. Correct. 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 So you see, that's exactly what I'm saying. What you have noticed here, I used only macroscopic models. Only the triphasic model was the microscopic one. All the rest are microscopic. So really here it becomes important to look back at the microstructure and build up. All the... Correct. Correct. So those Lameckeres constants, I actually got them from Goldsmith. So Goldsmith had a beautiful paper in 2001, I think, where he was reviewing all the literature out there on the brain mechanics. And one of the parameters I got were from there. Again, we have to remember one thing. The brain ages, so whatever I see at NPH is not going to be the same as for the child. So that's one thing that we have to account for. Plus, in hydrocephalus, it might very well be that the parameters, the mechanical parameters themselves, change due to the condition. Yes, so those are not homogenized. That's true. So that's the next step that we actually have to take that model and bring it up at the macrostructure and see what the homogenized parameters look like. Correct. Look, I saw it.
What's actually being measured is water.
Yes, diffusion tension.
Over 1 millimeter. But you can measure an animal with animal scans, dead tissue, and you can get better resolution, but not
great. Yeah, 1 millimeter is probably 1.1.
The shear, but the shear was performed in the mouth. Yes, yes. Please. Is lower. Is lower. Correct.
Could you also compare the deformation characteristics for white matter and gray matter?
I can't do that. So you see, because I was using the fMRI, okay, so it was the fMRI signal from that certain region in the brain which was responsible for the typing, the finger typing. So that's that was really the purpose of doing this model, was only to see if I can somehow make use of that fMRI information. In order to answer your question, I have to do what Martin was saying. I have to do the homogenization, so I can't tackle that problem yet. I will expect to see a stiffer brain for a very short period of time when the neurons are firing. But that will probably be disconfirmed as usual by the model, but I don't know yet. But the bottom line is that triphasic model has to be homogenized and then get the macroscopic parameters that somehow are going to depend on what happens at the microstructural level, including the neural activity. Yes. Oh, yes. I don't know. So that's the thing which I really... So the way I was... 140, I was doing it in the in the linear way, so I think I want half 70 something. Probably. So that's exactly the thing. So really the only purpose for this model was just to see if the model can somehow predict NPH. And now it is here where clinical information or chemistry has to be come in. So what I'm saying is, look, I have a model. Now I need the reality to come in and see if it's actually possible. Yes. So.
Generally, though, you know, when you stress off and you motivated, I mean, it looks like if there's some condition, clinical condition, it was a stiffening of the material. Right?
Correct.
I mean, or as a
correct
characterization.
Correct.
Of the disease.
Correct. Yes. And but in that particular model, was simply saying that after a stroke, the activity is not recovered at the same amount, and therefore you are going to see that in the mechanics. Really, that was the purpose.
Comparing
to normals, yeah, that was really the only purpose. So again, as I said, I'm trying to somehow bring the modeling closer to things that can be measured in a clinical sense, such that I can actually make use of those measurements and say something about the mechanics.
Okay. Well, let's thank Karina again.
Thank you.